Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the hosts or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Buenos dias. God morning. God Monday morning. Assalamu alaikum. How are you?
Alaykum as-salam.
Good.
Doing good.
Alhamdulillah. Well, we made it through the weekend. Another Monday. In the right position. So let's get started. I feel like where, you know, these Mondays sometimes, you remember the movie Groundhog Day?
Yeah, remember that?
Yes, it's like we would keep repeating the same thing. We wake up Monday and there's a news story about a gunman. And they tend to be from... Okay, it's not Florida, it's Texas. Now this is Virginia. Now Virginia is Idaho. Now Idaho is Georgia. And, you know, his thoughts and prayers being flung all over the place, but never a solution. I'm not often in my flabbergasted, but this is You know, and then it's not even just the guns. Now this guy decides he's going to ram his car into a crowd of people. There's something in the water. I'm convinced. I'm in water, so, you know, I'm gonna say there's something in water. It's in those. Yes, this guy, it has to be. There is. Okay, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and people keep saying it's mental illness. And I'm going to take a little bit of deference because I don't think always mental illness. I think it has to be something else. What do you say? What do you say?
There's so many factors and so many pressure points, touch points that people are subjected to that I think help to contribute to this problem. We just live in a very violent society, you know. A great deal of the entertainment and cultural expression, you know, are saturated with the theme of violence. And then when you have these states such as Texas and Florida that have some insane gun regulations or lack of regulation, when people are not really reminded or taught about legislation that does not include violent action. You know, I heard one commentator, I think he was a former, he was some kind of former law enforcement officer, may have been FBI, or either FBI or ATF. And he was saying that people don't understand the rush that the individual can get who uses one of these AR weapons, that, you know, that sense of power that that just overwhelms them. So, which I thought was an interesting perspective. I don't recall hearing other so-called experts, you know, give that explanation as far as why this attachment and this automatic, you know, reaching for the weapons of war, really. And then you contrast that with the subway agency who use a chokehold to actually kill someone who is experiencing a mental crisis. And then you choose to just choke the person to death, you know, similar to the police officer who killed George Floyd. I mean, it wasn't a short period of time. They said this man choked Jordan Neely for about 15 minutes. And many people have commented that it's a reflection on the lack of empathy that we have in the society, as far as those who are homeless or unhoused, who are poverty-stricken, who are, you know, suffering many, many different pressures, what do? We resort to violence. And although he was loud and aggressive, Jordan Neely hadn't put a hand, he hadn't missed a finger on anyone else. But yet, what is the response he gets? He gets a deadly response. So, very disappointing, and it really makes us, I think we have to take stock of ourselves as American citizens. What kind of society do we want to live in? Certainly not this one, for me.
Go ahead, she said it for me.
I was going to say that we had an interfaith discussion around violence, as a part of our Family Energy Day here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, balancing some other issues. But the bigger theme was what has happened to humanity's attitude towards humanity. Because of the root cause of violence, there's a disregard fundamentally for another human being, that you can treat them as less than you to begin with, or treat them less than you, and do things to them that you would do for someone outside of yourself that you really perceive as being less than you or less than human in some cases, especially a young man who was on the subway system in New York, and a little guy from the military put a chokehold on him until he basically died. Now, you know, to subdue a person is one thing. To take a person's life is something totally different. And when you go into a shopping mall, it's what happened in Allen, you know, Texas, and just randomly use an A-15 to shoot people randomly, to kill 8 innocent people and injure more than that. And it's a repetitive thing, so we've got to be very truthful. There has to be an address of some of these assault weapons. Something needs to be done with them being so available to anyone, not to mention the effort goes into acquiring one, some safeguards, as they call them, red flags, to ensure that those that are mentally stable, as they say, are the only ones that can have access to them. But we got to reduce this attitude first. Why do we need so many guns in this society? We have more guns than we have people. And our population is over 300 million people in this country. So why is it necessary? A part of that, I think, comes from a lack of understanding of what the Second Amendment really says. And people use it as their defense mechanism. But if you really take the time to study that amendment in the Constitution, it does not say anything about you buying a tank or assault weapons in your house and buy 600 rounds of ammunition for you to protect yourself in the name of the Second Amendment. It's a whole different thought pattern that went into that. And inshallah, sometime we can talk about that. But the essential thing now is, why do we have this almost celebration of violence as the alternative way to work with each other that we disagree with? And why do we respond so quickly to grab a weapon to do harm to an innocent society? We have to take a position. In fact, we wrote a little preliminary resolution entitled Act Now, Pray Later. And it sort of summarizes, you know, my specific perspective of this whole matter. We got to take some action. Talk is cheap. I'll stop right there because I'm going to get into another tangent. I apologize for getting up on my soapbox, but it's just, you know, we got to be for real about this whole thing, you know, inshallah. All right, I've said enough.
Raised some good points, and that kinds of discussions are happening at the grassroots level in terms of organization. But I think we have to put pressure on elected officials. Just like we know Alex, we talked about them a couple of weeks ago, and you mentioned them, the American Legislative Exchange Council. We know that they've been influential in getting these different state actors, you know, governors and state legislatures to pass these kind of bills that we see, you know, with permitless carry and all of that. I think that we have to pressure elected officials at the federal level to ban the manufacture of assault weapons, the manufacture of them for civilian consumption. Now, if they want to manufacture it for military purposes, I even have some reservations about that, the way they say how devastating these weapons are. But definitely a ban as far as manufacturing distribution to civilians. I think that is something I haven't heard a lot of people talk about, but I think that was something that will put definitely a pause on the availability. They say there's so many of these weapons already in the society that people feel that, you know, sensible gun regulation is not going to do anything. But I think make those manufacturers feel some pressure on their pocketbooks for them making billions of dollars off of, you know, human blood. This is really blood money. And then also putting liability on manufacturers when these type of weapons are used by civilians in these kind of mass shootings that we see. That's one step. And maybe that'll put a crimp on these white supremacy and neo-Nazi organizations who are trying to fan a civil war. You know, some people are saying that we're in a cold phase of a civil war right now. But these kind of mass shootings are fanning the flames of these hate mongers that hang out on the internet and radicalize a lot of us, our weak-minded citizens. That's it for me on that topic.
Well, I agree 100%. We can put some pressure on those gun lobby organizations, too, because they put a lot of money into some of these candidates' campaigns. And I won't go into the amount of money, but it's, you would be surprised. There's millions of dollars that they pay or contribute to these campaigns to keep these legislators on their side. And they're the ones who always say, my heart goes out to you, and we must pray for the family. But I'm sorry, that's simply, in this day and time, not enough. But the pressure is very, very important. And the citizens have to be, you know, released to share their outrage at this foolishness and come out of this fear, you know, environment that they try to keep us in. Fear just, you know, promotes fear. And we have to get beyond that to really be able to see each other as fellow human beings. And there's much more to be said, but the pressure on elected officials is a good starting point. The pressure on these gun lobbyists is a good starting point. And then hold these people accountable. Hold them accountable.
Yes.
Well, here's the problem we have. We have people conflating someone's so-called so-called religious belief with the inability to actually make concrete legislative decisions that save lives. The congressional rep for the district where this latest incident occurred actually said this. He said, many people argue that prayers aren't cutting it. Those are people, they don't believe in an almighty God who is absolutely in control of our lives. They are somebody who, as both of you have wisely mentioned, who accepts money from gun lobbyists. They are someone who keeps saying the people who are doing this are, you know, we need to be talking about mental health instead of assault weapons. And then he decided to deflect. He decided to say that he wanted to avoid making this tragic incident political and wanted to point to violence in big cities because, you know, the rise of those violent incidents, we should not talk about the rise of those violent incidents either. In particular, he has done what a lot of places do when they have these type of tragic incidents, and they keep pointing to Chicago. Look at Chicago, 7 million people, and their crime is spiked. And it's a Democratic city. We think our city in Allen, Texas, is a very safe area. We are 107,000 people. We don't have near the violence that they have in Chicago, where they're trashing stores and having violent riots. We don't have shootings every weekend. We're very safe down here. We just have people driving cars through crowds and coming up with assault weapons and shooting people because, you know, shooting someone in a mall when you're supposed to be okay just going shopping is okay. That is what has been the issue. They repeatedly turn to Crime is America as this talking point and then framing it in a way to say that, well, this large, and I'm not speaking as if Democrats and Republicans, anybody is any better than the other one, but when you try and frame it as, well, these large Democratic run cities have problems too, that what aboutism, rather than watching and saying, not a red state or blue state, but these little children don't know anything about Republican or Democrat. This 5-year-old who was killed, that 8-year-old who was killed, the 90-year-old, all their family knows that they were gay. And in 2020, if you look per capita murder rates, it was 40% higher in the states that were run by the last president than it was by the current president. And that's by independent report, not by you know, some partisan report. So all of these kind of pointing fingers has nothing to do with it. In San Mateo County this weekend, they had a gun buyback. 9 assault weapons, 4 ghost guns, 264 firearms were hauled away in 4 hours. They were bought with cash with no questions asked. 264 firearms in 4 hours.
That's more than 1 a minute, huh?
More than 1 a minute. Let that sit with you, audience. 9 assault weapons and 4 ghost guns. Guns, is for those who may not know, are things that you can literally print from a pattern on the internet that have no traceable numbers and features. Along with that, I wanted to also push that the state lawmakers are also addressing another crisis in our community, the fentanyl crisis. We've taken all kind of measures. They're distributing this overdose-reversing drug, Narcan, which has gotten bipartisan backing. And now they're pushing for harsher punishments for drug dealers. However, they've also found that they're getting pushback against what has been called, you know, this failed war on drug policy from the 1980s. But that failed war on drug policy mostly affected who did the war on drugs affect in the 1980s?
African American and Latino people.
Exactly. Those black and brown people who were affected in the 1980s, they're still in jail. They're still in jail right now. 30, 40 years later, they are still in jail from the 80s and the 90s. So you're not going to get in most black and brown communities to sign off on having easier punishment for those who tend to be dealing in opioids and fentanyl right now don't generally come from the black and brown community, yes?
So you're talking about the high level, the big forces in charge. Is that what you're
yes,
saying?
Ma'am. Yeah? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
The ones making
it's causing the
big, the billions and the trillions of dollars.
Yes, ma'am. It is not. So we've got a problem here. So what do we do? What do we do? Do we go back to these failed policies and we load up? This is somebody who is not a cheerleader for the carceral system. I am a cheerleader for equity. So do we go back and how do we give somebody back their lives from 30, 40 years ago because we know it didn't work? Or do we make sure we have equitable policies when it comes to criminal punishment system? What do we do? What say you?
Yes, Sister Cheryl, one thing that I'll give an example of in Forsyth County, when I served as county commissioner, we were participating in a lawsuit against the producers of these opioid drugs. And there was a number of states involved in that, and we finally won a lawsuit. And the county of Forsyth got about maybe $120 million as our portion of that. But we're taking those funds to create what we call some solutions to this whole opioid problem. And so the court system is an avenue if you have that kind of resources to pursue these people and hold them accountable. That's why the law is meant to no end, to know that these gun manufacturers are given a green light. They're not even brought to court for responsible building all these guns far in excess of what we need. and then they're used to take a human life, there's no accountability. They say the human or the gun doesn't kill, it's a human who pulls the trigger. That's a bunch of stuff, to put it mildly. But the court system is one avenue. We can't rely on old, worn-out policies. We have to face the reality of what's happening today and what can we do today to make a difference. And there's much to be said about that. And there's no question the injustice done to our people who will be jailed for having a gram or an ounce of this or that and given long life sentences. And all of a sudden now you have this slap on the wrist for those who are making fentanyl and other drugs. There's no way to justify that. And at one point, again, we got to hold these lawmakers accountable, our representatives accountable, and then we have to sort of inspire our own people, too, as an alternative lifestyle to a great degree. That's a part of our responsibility as well. And I don't want to take up any more time on that because I have a very strong feeling. I've lost so many relatives to drugs in my personal family, especially heroin, and so I have a zero tolerance for anything related to that. So pardon my acumen when it comes to discussing this whole drug situation.
Well, also, you know, to continue your thought, or what I perceive to be your thought, Brother Fleming, what's going on in the individual? We know that through the opioid crisis, a lot of people got hooked innocently because of the easy prescriptions that doctors gave to people who had, like, maybe back injuries or athletes who had maybe a torn ACL or whatever. So people who had suffered some kind of injury, they were prescribed these opioids, and they got hooked on them. So I think we have to demand more from the medical profession in terms of prescriptions and monitoring what's actually going on with the patient. And then with the fentanyl or even heroin, because we know that if the fentanyl is too expensive, people will go back to the use of heroin. We have to look at maybe what is driving the person to want to have that altered state. And they want the altered state. Many times they're self-medicating from depression or the circumstances of their life that have them so wanting to escape. And so then they use these artificial means, and then their body gets hooked on it. You know, that craving for that artificial high, that drug is there. And so, you know, I think if we look at how do we help to restore the human being to want to live the natural life, have that natural high because of you can just appreciate Allah's creation, or you can just appreciate the circumstances of your life. You can be grateful for the circumstances of your life if you're not burdened by the inequalities that exist in our society that have people hemmed in on all sides. So they just, you know, you're trying to seek some relief. And the relief that they go to is something that really destroys their life. And so I understand what you're saying, you know, and it seems to be cyclical, the drugs that they funnel into the community. Because I can remember growing up as a young child, my grandmother had a brother who I just loved, and he was hooked on heroin. And so we're talking about back in the 50s, I think he must have died of an overdose before I was 12 or so. So we're talking about the 50s and late 50s, early 60s. So these problems have plagued our community. I think there's a lot that we can learn from the healing approach that Elijah Muhammad used in the Nation of Islam, you know, keeping people busy, giving them a better picture of themselves. We know it wasn't the true picture of the Creator, but encouraging the human being to be better, to strive for stronger morals, you know, building up the individual and building up the society and freeing us from the image that has kept so many people down. That false image that we give of God has something to do with it also. And I granted enough, so excuse me.
No, I don't think it's a rant. I think it's we're waiting for the guest to call in. I sent you guys a message, so check your message. I think it's I think they're tied together. I think the whole the need for, you know, we live in this microwave society where, you know, you have to have instant gratification, or some have to have instant gratification, and we've taught people not to be patient, not to, you know, I drove down here for the concert today. I arrived, and there was a young man training at the front desk at the hotel. He's training. And I'm saying that to emphasize that he was a trainee, and it said it on his name tag. And so he didn't know how to do something that he needed to do for me to have this room. You know, to make sure that I had an ADA compliant room and all the other stuff. And he said, "Oh, just be patient with me." I said, "No problem. I understand." And I could tell that he was already set for me to be upset. And I said, "It's okay. I understand. I get it." And he said, "I'm just training. I have to get my supervisor to do it for you." And he was so apologetic. I said, "Joshua, I understand. It's okay. We all have to learn somehow. I get it." And he asked me if I wanted to take a seat until she could come. And I said the whole drive down, "I'm good." And the seat was too low. He went in the back and he got a chair for me from the office, which had a higher back and whatever. I said, "Thank you. It's very sweet." And one of the other supervisors came over and he said, "You know, I apologize for the wait." And I have a sneaky suspicion they saw my status with Marriott, you know, and thinking that, you know, making me wait was going to be a big deal. I get it. Some people, they have a certain status, and, you know, you walk in and you're supposed to get served right away. And that's it. He said, "He's just training with us." I said, "And he's doing a fabulous job. He's okay." And they said, "Thank you for your patience." Said, "First of all, I'm a parent of three, patients a long time ago, and he's okay. He's doing a fabulous job. I understand. And thank you for the chair. Would you like the water?" "Yes, thank you for the water. It's fine. I will be fine. Thank you so much." I don't think I waited 7 minutes before they took care of the issue to make sure that I had a room I'm supposed to have, beautiful view, whatever I needed. But what struck me was how, and I know it's beautiful customer service and whatever, but they were very apologetic for him being a trainee. And once I got everything I needed, and I said to him, "It's okay." And there was another lady who came over, and she was behind me, and then she saw that his desk was empty. She said, "Have you been helped?" Because I know, I saw it. I said, "Yes, he's very helpful. I think they're going to get you someone else because he's training, but he's very good." And she said, "Oh, we all have to learn somehow, right? And we're in this culture where we can't even let someone make a mistake or an error or have that kind of grace, right, without something being wrong with him. This is why people turn to other other means, right? I don't think it's always, we always want to say there's something mentally wrong with, you know, there's a mental health issue. We are in, I think we mentioned already, this is May, it's Mental Health Awareness Month. There's a difference between having a mental health issue and just being in this society, right? In a society that is expecting perfection. And that's not a mental health issue. That's a societal issue. We experienced it last week with one of our guests. When you're constantly being attacked for not being perfect in someone else's eyes, I don't think that's mental health. I think that's a society problem, not a mental health problem. As Muslims, we go through this, and I'm going to pivot to Muslimas. We had a wonderful event on Saturday where we discussed this. You know, oh, your hairline is showing, or your clavicle is showing, your hijab is not adjusted quite right, or you're not perfect in your, as men or women in Islam, you didn't pronounce something exactly the right way in your enunciation of an ayah, or when you are pronouncing a prayer or enunciating a prayer, as if any of us are perfect in any language. I speak 9 languages. And I won't tell you that every one of them is perfect, but someone somewhere is going to pick at something because we do petty better than anybody. And that petty is as if we are perfect, and none is perfect but the Creator. And that can lead people to doing things that they normally probably would not do. Sometimes that something could be in the form of, you know, these illicit drugs. Sometimes it's in the form of overeating, right? Or it could be, you know, other addictions. There's drugs and alcohol and food addicts and sex addicts and even people exercise too much, or you know, they ruin their marriages, or they spend too much, shopping addictions and other things like that. But it's all trying to reach some level of perfection because we don't have the type of dedication and control to be patient with the work that we need to put into ourselves to stay on this pathway that we're supposed to be on.
That's true.
Sure that
mm-hmm. Great.
That's so insightful.
And then we'll take a quick break.
On a program discussing life at 622 A.D., when the Medina Charter was first formed by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the reality of the cultures then. And even with that reality, people just 1 inch above savagery in some cases, he had the foresight to allow those people to maintain their culture because they had their value system checked in that, and they were able to conduct themselves accordingly as long as they didn't break the peace. The Jewish community then, even in your 3 of them, they had some issues. They were allowed to worship in their own fashion as long as they didn't break the peace. So this prophet, with the grace will always be upon him, established a pluralistic society in 622 A.D. Now, I'm a brief historian. I'd like to read a lot of, but that reality of what life was like then compared to what we have to face today, it's like night and day. These people didn't have a regard for each other, human beings, period. They went into the tribal mode, and if you violated the tribe, you were in serious trouble for generations out. It wasn't just next week. The son and the grandson also held that against you until some kind of, as they perceived it, justice was done. Why am I saying that? If we have a sense of the history, we can better understand what's happening today. Our condition, even though we're more enlightened, we still have a problem seeing other people with value as we see ourselves. That comes from a very, very low self-esteem. If you feel good about yourself, you don't mind sharing that with someone else. But if you have a problem seeing the value within yourself, it's very difficult to see value in someone else. And every child you see, every adult you see, you didn't create that person. That's a creation designed by Almighty God Allah. And the best you can do is get out of their way and let them become the person they should become, or assist them, if you can assist them in a way, to grow and develop. And that's the duty of a civilized society, to teach uncivilized. I'll stop there because I don't want to get too far into that, because we have guests, I'm sure. I didn't get a chance to read the message, but I will in a minute, Sister Cheryl. Sister Amato, I'm going to cut you off, sister. I apologize.
No, no, it's fine. You get the points that I would mention. I wanted to just say, of course, Cheryl's point about that legislator in Texas, you notice he identified himself as, "I'm a Christian," and anyone who doesn't believe in prayer. So the implied implication is, if you're not a Christian and believe as I believe, then you're missing the boat. And so just for our audience wanting to share, you know, Allah tells us in the Quran that the remembrance of Allah is the greatest force. So we do believe in prayer, but we also know that the Creator judges us by our intention and also our actions. So it's more than for, we didn't elect the legislators to pray. They were elected to facilitate government of the society by enacting laws and regulations. And so, like you said, Cheryl.
Say that again for the people in the back. Say it again.
Okay, we didn't elect them to pray. We elected them to facilitate the peaceful existence in society through legislation and regulation. And so I think that we just have to remember that. And like you said, don't let them deflect away from the problem. Like, you know, they really think that the general public is stupid. That's the only way I can say it. Governor Abbott had the nerve to say it's a mental health issue. And I think it was one of the states, the Texas state legislators that was on a program that said in 2015 or 2019, Governor Abbott, the one who's talking about mental health today, slashed over so many millions of dollars from mental health programs in Texas. So what is it? You want to take away from the mental health resources of your state, or are you just going to point the finger at people who may have mental health issues? So we as citizens, it is our responsibility to pay attention. That's one thing that we have to do. We have to pay attention to what these leaders are saying and what they are doing or not doing. And we have to take action to protect our interests, our safety, and our peace in the society. That's it.
Absolutely. And before we take a break, I wanted to bring up one more thing that's happening on the news that a lot of people will find interest in. There's, I ain't tell the truth. There's two more things. Because this one's big, and it's going to have a big resounding effect in California, but it will also have a resounding effect across the nation, depending on what happens. So if anyone's paying attention, you'll know that the California Reparations Task Force finally sent in its report to the governor, recommending the package comes out to billions of dollars. and it averages out to about 1.2 million per eligible resident, and the eligibility really stems from how long you live in the state, how long, and your linkage to chattel slavery in the United States. So, yeah, my Caribbean friends, I'm going to tell you, you may be eligible for reparations, just not this one. But it doesn't mean that you're not ineligible, but only if there's a linkage to chattel slavery in the United States, United States-based chattel slavery, let me say it that way. And people who just moved here to California a few years ago, yeah, no, don't go looking for your check. Not going to be there. This is really about people who have had a long-time presence in the United States and in the California. And, yeah, that's the recommendation. Now, how does that affect people outside of California? Well, the way California goes, so does the recommendation. Yeah, the recommendation is really watching what California does. And as the fourth largest economy in the world, and let me say that again, the fourth largest economy in the world, that means that only the United States, China, and Japan have larger economies than the entire state of California has larger economies than any other nation outside of the United States, China, and Japan. let that ruminate while we go on this commercial break. And then I want to talk about that as well as student loans really quick before we get to this topic today about being young and elected. But I did want to put that on your mind because this reparation conversation has been going on for nearly half a century, and we have not made, and this is the first time we're making any type of progress on it. Right? Are we good on that?
Yeah.
We'll take a break first, and then we'll come back, and I'll hear what you two have to say. Okay. Thank you.
God's peace be upon you. God's love be upon you. God's compassion be upon you. The one soul of humanity. May we let it be in thought and in action. On behalf of CWSC Intelligentsia, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected, American Muslim 360, the Speakers Bureau, the Model Community National Resource Directory, the Volunteer Human Resource Network, Scholarship, the Learning Lab, Ambassadors, National Leadership Advisory Council, Internship, Leadership Development Council, The Think Tank, Strategic Family Institute, The Bookstore. May we share completely humanity in spirit and in form, from thought to action. God's peace, God's love, God's compassion. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sebastian Maniscalco, and my grandfather passed away from Alzheimer's disease in 2005. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America is a national nonprofit agency that's here to help. If you or someone you love has questions about the disease, need someone to talk to, pick up the phone. Call Alzheimer's Foundation of America. Don't be embarrassed. They're here to help you. Call 866-232-8484. Don't forget.
Join us every Monday from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Time for an episode of Optimal Health with your host, Abdul Shaheed, your certified symptometry health coach and doctoral student at the American School of Symptometry. It is our aim and objective every week on am360.org to enlighten health-conscious individuals on root cause therapeutics and provide them with guidance on general wellness and cell nourishment. Planet Earth is well known in symptometry as an echo chamber of illusion and a testing ground with booby traps everywhere. Come join us each week to learn about these booby traps that cause health to be denied. Connect at am360.org and 24-hour streaming at 701-719-4197. Call in to listen to speak to the host at 515-605-9891 or 425-292-4253. Share comments at info@cwsc.us. Tweet us at CWSURA. Email us at info@cwsc.us. Visit our parent corporation, Community-Wide Surers Conference, at cwsc.us. Or leave a listener comment at 910-31.
Join us for Muslim American Power 5 on Mondays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Muslim American Power 5, referred to as MAP5, featuring Sister Amatullah Sabri, Sister Cheryl Sadi, and Brother Fleming Alamein. That's Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time for MAP, Muslim American Power 5.
All right. We're back. All right. So when we left, I was mentioning to you guys about the reparation recommendation, the reparations task force recommendation. And actually, Congresswoman Barbara Lee spoke at the last meeting about the need for actual checks to be distributed as well as the other things in the task force that were, you know, we need community centers, we need scholarships, we need education, all of those things. But she specifically said we need the money. What do you guys think about especially the $1.2 million per resident, eligible resident?
That's tricky. That's very tricky. I don't recall the figures offhand. Do you recall the figures offhand that the Jewish community got back in World War II and the Japanese community got? Because I think that's what would be the first objection that would come up.
The Japanese descendants... Under Reagan, they got $20,000 per family. They could prove they were placing those encampments during World War II.
Okay, and the Jewish citizens. Maybe we need to go back and research that.
Have to research that one, yes.
But you would have to remember. You would have to account for, you know, the amount of time.
Yep. Good.
That is passed.
Yeah, you have to adjust.
And you'd have to adjust
yes.
it. You'd have to adjust it. And you'd have to adjust for the number of years. Right. But the number of years chattel slavery existed in a number of generations that were affected by chattel slavery, which is, by all accounts, a lot longer than both of those situations. And so, which is how it was calculated. There was a very intricate process in calculating this money.
Okay, so that's how they got the $1.2 million per person?
Yes, ma'am.
I have to think about it. I mean, I would love to get $1.2 million. Don't, without having to play the lottery, don't think I wouldn't. I have to think on that a little bit more, to be honest. Because there might be better ways. Is that going to be a taxable amount? That's another thing you have to consider. There might be better ways to get it, you know, housing vouchers or educational vouchers. You know, there might be other ways to do it that you can get the equivalent of that money but not incur a tax bill for getting that money, if that makes sense. And, yeah. You know, that's that. When you look at today, people don't even want to teach about slavery. I'm not just talking about people in the South. I'm talking about people down in Irvine and down south in some of those Republican strongholds. That is going to cause a big problem, and repair is needed, but I wouldn't want a repair that's going to cause more problems, if you know what I mean. I have to think about it.
Yes. Well, go ahead, Brother Cameron.
Yeah, I think it's admirable that the state of California is willing to do that. I'll give you an example of what happened in North Carolina. It took us about 12 years to get compensation for families that were illegally sterilized. It was called the Eugenics Project, supported by the state of North Carolina,
right,
and some, quote, families of stature for many years. In fact, that program went all the way up until 1974, and the justification they had was feeble-minded women did not need to be producing children. So that's a heck of a thing to say about anyone.
Yes. What about those feeble sperm?
Yeah, precisely. And so they cut these people literally from having children. And in the end, Senator Earlene Palmer, a good friend of mine, she's transitioned back to the law, and Representative Larry Wumble, he also has transitioned back to the law. It took them literally 10 years to get the General Assembly in North Carolina to agree finally to compensate these families. And the dollar amount behind all of that tragedy, if they get, you know, identify the relationship and that tragedy in our state, they gave those families $20,000 each, which I thought was an insult. But at least it gave them something, a gesture saying, I'm sorry. There's no way in the world you can compensate someone for taking away their life opportunities going forward.
Yeah.
The North Carolina was the first state to at least recognize you did wrong. Let's do something to correct the situation financially. So I applaud California. We've had this discussion for some time in North Carolina. Some counties have taken a lead. We have some counties up in the rural mountainous area of North Carolina who apologize for slavery. They're trying to come up with a way to compensate through education, scholarships, et cetera, through some means to say, listen, we did this. Let's do something to correct the situation. But it's been a mosaic of different approaches. No one has agreed on one specific methodology to address the issue. So I applaud, again, California for taking a lead on that. It's going to be a battle out here in some of these states. I'm always good for a fight. It's in my nature.
Heavyweight champion of the world.
I know we have one of the guests on. I just want to say real quick, I think that Sister Masla, that part of the package is the education, the housing, debt relief, that is all included in the package, and tax tax relief. I did want to, when I'm looking at it, I'm not focusing on the amount per se, just that there is a check. So, and I think that part of setting the amount at that 1.2 is knowing that it's going to get negotiated. It was to set that amount at an amount to, yes, to shock the conscience, but also to equate to the amount of harm that has been done, and
so
to make sure that it's,
is the 1.2 million in addition to those housing, this, that, and the other, or does everything add up to? So it's 1.2 plus those.
Plus the ability, plus the ability to have housing, education, debt relief, all of that is part of the package. Yeah. The 1.2 is in addition. There's supposed to be, it was very important that this package include an actual check being cut, not this symbolic. Not the symbolic, we apologize and let us give this symbolic gesture by building a community center that some people will never benefit from. Or let's build you a statue that says, I apologize. No, give people a check because of so much generational wealth that has been lost because of stolen land and stolen futures and stolen bodies from the Black community through chattel slavery. That is what that was for.
Yes, you know, there are three survivors still from the Black Wall Street massacre who have been fighting with their state legislators to get reparations for those individuals. They're the only three that are surviving from those who were killed and massacred and forced to move away. So it's a long fight that's ahead. Not to say I'm with assuming that we don't fight, but we have to know, like I said, the white supremacists, the so-called conservatives, the ignorant who don't have any idea what African Americans lost in this country as a result of our enslavement. That's a whole education. You have to spend maybe $10 billion in education just for people to realize that there was harm done and that there should be some repair for reparation. But we have one of your guests on the line, so I don't want to take up any more time from him.
Yes,
maybe,
and I think that this is yes, and so let me preface. Melvin Willis is he was elected to the Richmond City Council here in Richmond, California. Richmond has long been one of as small as Richmond has been a progressive stronghold in politics and has been known nationally for some of its very forward-thinking stances in environmental protection, in economic wage and minimum wage, helped lead efforts towards banning the box, has been taking on Chevron with some of its environmental mishaps in our community. And when Melvin was elected, he was one of, if not the youngest, of city council members to be elected into city council, but also local leadership. And one of the things that I admire most about him is that he gonna hold his tongue on this show, but he doesn't mind not biting his tongue when it comes to making sure that people are properly housed, fed, have clean air, clean water. We have been working together side by side for a long time, He does great work with ACE, which is the Association. I don't want to get it wrong. I'll let him tell you, but doing a lot of housing work in not only in Richmond but in the East Bay and throughout Northern California. And we work together with the Racial Justice Coalition in the East Bay. Melvin, welcome to the show.
Hello, y'all can hear me right now, right?
Loud and clear. Absolutely, sir.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah, so glad to have you on the
show. And it stands for Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, ACE. Took me about a month or two to finally get it down.
I knew I was going to miss one of those C's. And welcome. We are talking this morning about being young and elected, young, black, and elected, but also just the importance, you know, this is Mental Health Awareness Month, also the importance of just, you know, while we're taking care of the community and also taking care of ourselves. You know, we have so much going on, and you and I talk about this often, and I know how long it took you to get to that point. Because you were on that verge of burnout. But let's first talk about this. I have a quick question for you.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're one of those, young millennials who grew up in this microwave culture that we've been talking about. Who, you know, me. What is it? Coming from Richmond and you know, the Iron Triangle, and just this seeing all of this violence and destruction around you, what was the trigger for you to run for office as a young man?
Well,
and what did it?
I mean, my journey into politics in this space was very, very spontaneous. I mean, I first even started getting more and more politically engaged as I became an outreach and then organizer with ACE. But I grew up in Richmond my whole life, and, you know, I was somebody that I could have had my life taken multiple times throughout my life. I was bullied. I had a low self-opinion about myself, but the thing that always made me feel good in general was if I was able to help somebody who was in need and, you know, actually needed the help, whether it's just somebody to confide in or to help deal with a situation that's very challenging. I try to do what I can as I can. And going in that outreach and community organizing, I just got to meet people in the community that felt similar to me, you know, felt similar concerns to me about feeling safe, about belonging in the community, and also felt similar and wanting to see a change, wanting to see the community thrive, wanting to feel safe, wanting to just step outside and just step outside without worrying about anything. And, you know, being able to offer a solution on how we can come together to get power in numbers to even get one step closer to that safety and to that vision we talked about is what got me more and more engaged. The thing that ended up making me run 5 years into my organizing work was we were fighting for rent control and just cause for eviction locally, passed it through the council, the whole petition process that got it repealed. Though we had many confessions saying not many people knew what they were signing. They thought they were signing something to benefit them, but turned out it was kind of like a bait and switch type of deal. Then we gathered more signatures, got it on the ballot, and there wasn't that many candidates outside of two that were really defending it. And in my work, I was on the ground fighting for it, and there was a lot of anti-rent control, just cause for eviction dialogue happening in these political spaces. So when I stepped up to run, it was to represent all the people that I talked to on the streets, all the stories that I collected and what this meant for them and why it would be important to them. Honestly, there wasn't even really an expectation that I'd win because I showed up so late, but I can at least carry that voice in these public speaking forums and as I'm talking to people at the door about the election. So quick 5-year summary, and that's sorry about that. That went on too long.
No, you're fine. I just remember it. I'm going to tell the audience, Melvin wasn't even driving. He was right. You were riding a bike. He was riding a bike around town. He was like, you were, that's how young he was.
A true environmentalist.
He was. And he was like, you know, he was so young and eyes wide open, and it was exactly what we look for. Sister Matala, you were an organizer. Brother Fleming, you were an organizer. And if you can just recall those early days of organizing, I mean, we're all organizers, and just that purity of I can change the world, and actually going out and doing it. And I was watching him, and I'm like, oh. He's so young.
I've always had, you know, this philosophy. It's like, I can't do everything, but I can do what I can in the capacity around me. I mean, I may not be able to identify each and every single issue surrounding me because, unfortunately, I'm not clairvoyant. I haven't developed that ability yet. But as I find out about something, working together with people to come up with a solution and say, hey, you're not alone. There actually is people that care, and there may or may not be a solution for you right now in your situation or a better one to come. But it's about having that conversation and doing the work and being willing to face those obstacles as they come up.
Yeah. It was beautiful. It was so raw. It was so raw. And I remember when they said, we need you to support this young man who's running, and I was listening to him, and when I first bucked him, I was like, of course I will. But yes, I remember that optimism. They stole it from me, but I remember this optimism. And we were...
Let me ask a question since you made that comment, though. Can you share with us maybe one or two things about your position or being immersed in this political environment that you didn't expect to encounter?
I didn't expect, honestly, you know, you hear so much about the dishonesty, and you hear so much about how much politics, because the people are so horrible. And I think that one of the things that I didn't expect is that, you know, people like Melvin, you know, he's like a little brother to me. And I didn't expect that they're really, he knows this already, that they're really people who are genuinely doing this because they really, really care at the deepest level. And that they're not in this for money or for headlines or for so-called clout. And they, you know, I told you, and when I met, it took years before he was driving a car because he it wasn't money, you know. He was willing to give up, you know, his last pennies to just do the work. And I think that what really was, like, surprising is that I know why I was doing it. And remembering that why for yourself is easy. But being around, because you always have that core group, and I know you guys know this, you always have that core group of people who are always going to do the work and always understand the why. But realizing that there's actually, that group is actually a little bit bigger than you would imagine looking from the outside. And when we were fighting for Chevron to take responsibility, when we were fighting for increasing the minimum wage, when we were fighting for housing, when we were fighting for ban the box, it was always this small group of people. We would turn around and they would say, Cheryl, you're everywhere. And I would say, and the only reason you know is because you're here too. It was things like that. They were like... I'm like, Melvin would send me a note, and he was like, go to bed. Why are you answering my text? I was like, why are you answering my text? you know. But it was always.
Because I need to give you mess about being a workaholic, that's why.
Yes, but he was also a workaholic, right? So we were all working for the same thing. And so that, I think, was a realization. And the second realization was there are people who really do have what he just said. You're a workaholic, take a break. And I can call him and say, you need to take a break. And really people who really do care about you outside of the work. And you don't get that very much. And you don't go into the work thinking that there's people who care about you as an individual, because there's so many other people who don't. In life, there's so many people who want to take as much as they can, and they drain you, and then they're nowhere around, right? They're nowhere around when you need something. But in our organizing circle, what I have found is that when my aunt passed away, when I had back surgery, when I needed, even when I didn't know that I needed somebody to be there, they were there. So I think that they do care. We've built this small core group of people who actually look out for each other and make sure that our, since we're talking about mental health, that our mental health is taken care of. When we saw Melvin, like, dude, you need to take a break. And he was like, yeah, I'm taking my sabbatical. And we were like, good, call me if you need me. We're not going to call you. We're not calling you. Mm-hmm. We'll see you when you get back. I think those are things is what I saw. So Melvin, what about you?
What about for Brother Melvin? Yeah.
One of the two things
that you've experienced that surprised you that you didn't anticipate before you were elected and before you went into this political arena?
I'll just say the one thing that actually surprised me the most is the amount of patience I was able to develop, and the fact that I haven't had I've had a couple, but not a massive outburst, because some of the tedious nature and arguments and tenseness of the discussion really is a mental trial. Like, it is an endurance test. And you can see around you during some of these, you know, controversial discussions when we're talking about increasing the minimum wage, housing protections, how to support homelessness and transition people out. How are we dealing with racial inequity in our city, and what are we doing to prioritize those most impacted? It's not a simple discussion, and especially on a council that's multi-generational and extremely diverse, not only ethnic-wise but income-wise. There's a lot of opposing views and opinions, and sometimes what I've noticed is there's a lack of diplomacy. So I found a real challenge between me wanting to be the diplomat and just represent my issues with respect and decorum versus me that grew up in Richmond and was bullied a lot, and what I've done to fight back whenever that comes. So I get triggered a lot. And the fact that I haven't said 90% of the things that actually go through my head out loud during a council meeting is one thing that has shocked me.
You can see it on his face, though. You can see it on his face. I watch him, and I'm like, please don't say what you're thinking. Please don't say what you're thinking, because you can see it on his face.
A whole meme catalog out of my face during council meetings. That's all I have to say.
Yes, especially when Mark Wahlberg, Washburg gets up and speaks. Hold that thought for just a moment. I do want to bring Princess Washington in on the conversation. She just signed on, and let me bring her in, because we've got I want to bring her in. Good morning, Princess. Princess Washington is another one of our fabulous young black electeds. She is our mayor pro tem in System City, here in California, and we are, you know, fabulous, fabulous, fabulous young elected, and we're having a conversation here with Melvin, and once Mayor Devin gets here, we'll bring him in as well. So we have a question on the table right now. I'm going to ask Sister Matula to repeat it. But we're just getting to know one another and talk about, you know, what got you involved. It, you know, it's one of the things where, you know, we always talk about making change, but making that actual leap from talking to doing. And then, Sister Matula, I have a question for you. So what made you make that leap? And then, Sister Matula, go ahead.
What made you make the leap, and then what expectations that you have that now you're surprised that you experience one or two other things in coming into that political arena, maybe something you didn't anticipate but you've experienced?
For me personally, what really, you know, kind of gave me the strength to make that leap is definitely the love that I have for my home city. I grew up here. I was born in Oakland, California. I grew up there as well, but I moved to Sissim City when I was 5, you know, like a lot of people from the Bay Area, making that exodus to the suburbs in order to purchase their first home. And so that's kind of what my father did. And, you know, I was able to, you know, ultimately really benefit from my father's hard work in moving here and seeking out this place. And, you know, I've always really loved Sissim City. It's very diverse. Really great place to grow up. And when I was given the opportunity to become a commissioner, you know, I'm an artist and I was an arts commissioner. That was an amazing experience. And then the lovely assemblywoman, Lori Wilson, got promoted to assembly for mayor of Sassoon. And then the wonderful Wanda Williams, who was on council, was running for board of supervisors. And so really for me, it was more so seeing that, you know, representation was going to lack, and I didn't know who else was going to run. And with their encouragement and that from the community, I actually, you know, kind of got the strength from that. And what really surprised me was the fact that I won and people were happy and they wanted me there. And even right now, I'm so well supported by the community, and I think that's a bit surprising because it can really be the opposite, right? You can really fail. Yeah. Most people fail the first election. So for me, I mean, there's just so much love here in this community. And I think I'm really the embodiment of that, of someone who can be homegrown and who just gives back to the people. And so for me, I think that's the most surprising thing, is that you can really be yourself and win an election. Like, I didn't seek to change myself. Yeah. I didn't seek to sell myself or be any different, and I'm really, really highly opposed to that. I believe in authenticity and being grounded and just serving the people on a personal level. And so for me, I think that was what's surprising, is that I didn't have to go to the great lengths or kind of be in the system as much as most people to get where I am. And nothing against the system, because we all have to partake in it. But I think that, if anything else, I'm living proof that you can just care and it can get you really far, you know. So I'm just grateful for that experience, for sure.
Fantastic. That's great. That's good to know. Good to know.
Melvin, did you want to say something else? I know I put you on hold for a second. So we could get,
I was just answering. Yeah, also, nice to meet you, Princess Washington. My sister actually listens to Soon.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
I got family in Richmond, Cheryl. So we can talk about family reuniting.
Yeah. So, we lost Brother Fleming. I think he'll dial back in. So what do you do? Because this one's really important. I know that, because especially because we know what that this can be really a mental drain. And Melvin, you brought this part up, especially when it comes to you making big decisions and not having the support, especially when we're going through these really heavy topics like rent control or housing issues or the moratoriums on rent and housing and economic issues, which we're going to be facing in all of our cities pretty soon, dealing with increasing the minimum wage again, our taxes on businesses. What do you do to make sure that in this field where that's so mentally and psychologically draining, and where we don't have a lot of, not only do we not have a lot of black and brown electives, but we don't have a lot for, you know, under 30, nevertheless under 40, right? Why do you, who are in their 30s, but nevertheless under 40, what do you do to protect and preserve your mental health and to support one another? What do you do?
I know for me, like over Zoom, everybody's seen my background. Like the very base level thing I do for myself is whenever I can, if there's nothing major happening, I just try to retreat in my home and just be to myself with my own thoughts and my own opinion, reflect a little bit on what happened, but also do something for myself. Like a casual video gamer, so I will pop something in and get lost in a story and interact with that and just do what I can to make sure that I'm living life as opposed to just surviving in it. I also have my dog that I take to the dog park to play with them, see everybody's funny reactions when they see a 2-year-old 90-pound dog that's silver just coming at them with a happy face and jumping 10 feet in the air. Like, and hanging out with my loved ones, my mom, my family, my companion. Like, I care about my community, and I want to make sure that there is a work-life balance to where I can be there for the community and take care of myself at the same time. And it's very difficult finding that balance, especially we're in a more agitated, raw society these days where folks really go hard or go home for their opinion and values to the point where they'll cut people off that they've known for years over that. So making sure that I'm finding a balance between living my life and enjoying life as I'm fighting for improvements that matter to the community as well. And those are just some of the things that I do on a daily basis to keep me grounded and make sure that I'm also not losing myself to this work. I'm growing in this work.
Really good. What about you, Miss Princess? What do you do? What do you do?
Sorry, did you reference me?
Yes, ma'am. So what do you do?
Oh, I mean, definitely, I think it's important to stay grounded and, you know, be around your family, your friends, those who truly love you for you, and really just trying your best. Luckily, you know, I have a good church family. You know, I believe in nature. I go on a hike, take my shoes off, go walk in the grass, right, just reconnect. Because all of this is fleeting, ultimately. And I always feel as though as long as you're trying your best and you can live by your choice and the decision that you make to represent those who don't have a voice, I think that's the most important thing that you can do. And I think once you kind of do that, you can live with all the decisions that you make. But again, to piggyback, yeah, you definitely have to disconnect and take some time. That quiet solitude time is much necessary. But, you know, that's kind of what we sign up for. And I think you have to be really tough. I think you can't be swayed by opinions or judgment, because ultimately no one knows you anyway, right? Only you really know you. And I think if you really know yourself, then you really have nothing else to worry about.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, it's true.
I have one question for both of our investigators. Mm-hmm. How much of the work that you have to do forces you to try and come up with workarounds on economic inequalities or trying to balance the budget or getting the budget to really have a positive impact on the community members' lives being improved? How much of your work involves that percentage-wise, and how does that affect you personally?
When it comes to definitely the budget pieces, I would just say, like, maybe for, like, the first 6 months of the year. So when I'm at council, like, half the time will be used to, like, look at the budget and the various requests that are coming in. The two things that, or three things briefly that come to mind is I know when the 2020 pandemic happened, I was very stressed and under a lot of pressure because the future looked very bleak from all the staff financial projections. So there was this huge push for potential layoffs and furloughs. And I work with labor unions all the time because I identify with them as being working people, families, just trying to live my life and mind my business. And trying to work with them between other city staff who are doing this analysis to come up with a solution that had the least amount of impact possible, that really stressed me out because we were also talking about potentially cutting services to people in the community with some of these things. And honestly, I think it was that was part of the reason why I had to take a sabbatical from my other job, just because it was a high-intense situation. But ultimately, I think we left with a more positive than negative result. The other thing in balancing communities' needs, when we're talking about job programs for youth, investing in the homeless solutions and housing, with everything that was going on in our country after George Floyd was murdered, it created a huge push nationwide, Richmond included, to talk about reimagine public safety. And I wish there were a couple of council members that handled the situation differently, but it became a very intense conversation on how are we reinvesting and redirecting excess in our police budget, which is the largest budget in Richmond, into these key areas that communities identified as needs. And going through that process was very tough. I feel like it could have been done a lot better, but there were positive things that come out of it to actually start getting youth into these job programs and building out that infrastructure and supporting transitioning homeless folks out of encampments into other living situations and collaborations with the county. So it really depends on what's happening in that year. It could take up about 40% of your time in any given year, and it could take up about 60% of your time, depending on how intense the situation is and all the stakeholders involved when you take in the fact the city council, city staff, and the community members, most importantly. And I think the most positive thing that has happened recently is for us, we're always worried about revenue. There are some settlements that will be drying up to where we'll be losing revenue. And our city staff did a phenomenal job just looking at who's paying what rates and fees into Richmond. And we noticed that PG&E wasn't actually paying as much to Richmond as they were doing with other cities in the PG&E network. And through discussions and negotiations, we actually just voted on a settlement last week that's going to fill in some potential revenue gaps. Even if some settlements that we've had in the past dry up, we're still having an ongoing revenue stream, so we don't have to worry about having those difficult discussions that I mentioned at the beginning of this. And I'll stop right there because I felt like I talked too much. Sorry.
No, that was very enlightening. Thank you for sharing that.
So Sassoon City is actually quite different. We are only a four square mile radius, about 30,000 people, and we actually generate one-third of the revenue of any other California city. So our challenges are like most small towns where we really don't have a lot of revenue, and this is actually my first go-around with doing negotiations for staff and labor. And I am a union member. I'm a Kaiser employee. And knowing what it really is to, you know, earn a paycheck and it not being enough sometimes. And so for me, I'm always advocating for those people, right, because I am that person. And so it's really challenging to be that person, but also having to be mindful of the limited budget of the city. But I always believe in trying to find that middle ground. And as he stated, yes, police is a large part of the budget. It's actually our largest part of the budget, but we need it. You know, public safety is very important. People do need to feel safe. And until we find an alternative, which, you know, who knows how long that can take, you know, it does have to be a part of the budget. And I do welcome that. But how do we create more avenues of equity with what we have? I'm a firm believer that we should give more funding to, you know, recreational programming to where people don't become criminals, right? We kind of have this military-industrial complex here in America where we'll fund the war but don't have money for poor. And I think that's really a large-scale issue that we have to readdress. But on a local level, you know, it is challenging having such a small budget like how Sassoon City has. And one thing that we do really, really need to do is look at Measure S, which is our general tax. It's a 1% blanketed tax. And if we don't have that, which it can sunset in 2026, like, we're literally screwed. And not only do we need to pass that measure again, we actually need to raise it. And, you know, no one likes to raise tax. But the reality is if we don't, our city is literally going to go bankrupt. Like, it's not a joke. It takes care of our public safety, so our fire department, our police department, all of these things that we need. But, you know, people being people, they focus on the potholes, right? So they think all the money should go to fixing the roads. So, for example, we have $2 million set aside to fix the roads, and everyone wants the roads fixed, but it'll only fix a mile of roading. So for me, I'm like, well, do we fix this 1 mile of road, or do we look at staffing needs, retention? We have a really high turnover right now. We're losing about 6 police officers, which is not a good thing, you know? So, you know, and it's interesting, especially being a black woman, who would have thought, you know, with everything happening that you would have to be on the side where you have to fight for police. But the reality is you kind of do, because police are the ones that you call. And until we can create a new system, which, you know, that may take a while, we have to work with what we have. And, you know, luckily we have an amazing police force here, you know, a great community aspect here. So a lot of the problems that are on a national level don't really affect us here locally. But not saying they don't matter, but I'm just speaking in the scope of my job description, you know. For us, we're actually losing police officers, and it's more expensive to contract with the sheriffs, right? So it's like, how do we, you know, do what we can to retain the things that we need for our city? And that really is a challenge in having such a limited budget, you know. I mean, I think we have a fraction of what most cities have, and I think most private companies have more money than what we do, you know, and that's the challenge is, when you're working in a public space, you're very limited on revenue sources. So for me, I'm trying to rack my brain about how can we create more economic growth within our small city that's pretty much developed. How do we utilize our assets to draw more people here? How do we bring in more business to where we can stop the leakage that happens here in Sassoon City and allow us to generate our dollar locally? That will kind of solve a lot of problems. But, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And right now we don't have either, you know, so it's like, how do we get this done? And then you realize in government, everything is so slow. By the time I do anything, I might have to run again, which, you know, do I want to run again? That's another issue. Like, this is difficult and very thankless. So it's like, you know, it's just really interesting, you know, being in charge of things that you had no hand in creating, but then you have to come up with a solution in 6 months and they blame you. You know, so it's just really interesting dynamic, you know. But I think when you care, that will always override all of the BS that you have to go through. And so that's kind of where I'm at is, you know, now we're in closed session, which is a whole different animal. You're seeing what's behind the Iron Curtain, and you're like, oh, my God, no wonder, you know. So it's just interesting, you know, it is. It's very challenging, and I caution anyone. I know we kind of get frustrated with government. But to the people who are in it, like, I applaud you because it's not easy. No matter who is there, like, it's not an easy job. And we complain, but we have to have grace for one another, you know, because it's not easy. And I don't think anyone, you know, in their right mind would sign up to this for the quote-unquote power because, you know, what is that, you know? You're at the whim of the people now, you know? So it's like you kind of have less power being in power, honestly. So.
And that's exactly what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear that sentiment, right? And that is the mental health aspect is balancing that need and that want to do for the community, and just with all of that and that frustration and that and that that it moves so slow, right? We have another one of your compadres on, so I'm gonna introduce him as well. But I love that, Princess. I'm gonna tell you that you're not alone. As with most frustrations, I think we all have been once you're elected. And I love that you get to see what's behind the Iron Curtain. And it is not pretty. That's where they sweep everything. You know, like if you, your parents ever tell you to sweep the kitchen floor, and when they're not looking, you get swept under the rug. That's what's behind that curtain. Hold on, just a minute. I do want to introduce another good friend of mine, Devin Murphy. Devin, welcome to the show. Devin is also Young Black and Elected, another one of these young men who is youngest elected to Pinole City Council, now mayor, El Mayor to Pinole. You know, he's doing great things there. Another environmentalist who has shaken up East Bay. Boy, we've got some great things happening in the East Bay. Don't be trying to move over here either. I know some of y'all want to be over here with us. But we've got Princess and Melvin and Devin and Alexander Walker Griffin, who wasn't able to attend today, but he's also mayor in Hercules. We've got Chanel Preston. We've got a lot going on here in East Bay. Welcome, sir. Say hello to the people.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And then your compadre, Ms. President
yes.
Washington, is on. Honorable
yes,
Mayor
Pro Tem Washington. Hello.
Hi, Devin. I love you.
I love you back. I'm sending love. And council members, oh, my God.
I know you're not calling me council member all the time. You don't know
I'll
me.
You,
hi,
I'll
Devin.
Call you mayor if you want to. I'll call you mayor if you want to, whatever you want. I just want to say that council member Willis has really set the tone on sustainability for elected officials and has done so much and has supported me in so many ways to set that vision for myself. Because what we know is that a sustainable elected official breeds a sustainable community. And I just want to honor what you just said. I heard a little bit about what you said about sustainability and just measuring our ability to manage and monitor our mental health, and then also bring in the partners to do that too. And I thought that was just so amazing to start off with, because I've had a long time, and I honor that, and I honor the certain things of that, and I just need to say that to start with that. That's important, everybody. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes.
Thank you, Devin.
You know, yes, it's not easy. It's not easy. But it's when you're true to the work, it makes it a little easier. But it's not an easy, task. So, I'm going to, Brother Fleming, I know you had a question, so I'm gonna move to you and let you ask your question, sir.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. And just congratulations on all the young energy that I feel in, here in the program here. I had one question very quickly. What have you each found to be your greatest asset or coalition element in the community to help you pass policy or ordinance to serve your constituents?
Yeah, I could take a stab at that. I think for me, the best asset that I have is the fact that I'm born and raised in Richmond, the fact that I didn't start driving till I was 26, so walking around or biking every place really put me out in the community to get more of a close-up view of those issues and identifying how I feel about it. And I think the other asset that's been very helpful for me is learning how to organize before I ran, because through that organizing background, it taught me better people skills. It taught me how to listen to a variety of opinions, both opinions that I support and both opinions that are against me or what I work with. It taught me really to be diplomatic and just hear both sides of the issues and say it's okay to have the biases that I have. I ran on a platform and I want to honor what I ran on, because too many people feel like they have a bait and switch where they're promised the world and they still don't get nothing. That was part of my disdain for politics when I was a teenager. You're just lying to me. You're a stranger. I don't believe you. I'm still broke. That's how I felt. So that organizing background and just being able to listen to folks and build up people's skills and learn to be more diplomatic and still be grounded in what I believe in but still respectful to my opposition is an asset that I feel like that I've developed over the years and that I'm personally grateful for.
Thank you.
Ms. Washington.
Yeah, you know, I would say for me, I think being accessible is huge, right? So especially for me growing up here, I never knew who the hell was in office. You didn't know the person. You would see the signs every 4 years, every other 2 years pop up, and that was it, right? So for me, I made it a point where, you know, I had my picture on my sign. You know, people knew who I was, and I'm really big on open lines of communication. Like, I'm on next door. I'm like, yo, call me if you got something to say, or how can I help you? Like, that's the biggest misconception. Like, we're here to serve you. Like, you pay me. You're paying my salary. You're paying for my phone that I have that you call me on, right? And so I'm very big on giving back in that way of being accessible. And I think that that's huge, is knowing who you can reach out to for help. That's the biggest thing that people need, especially on a local level. Like, you know, who do I talk to about this? Who can I call about that? And pointing them in the right direction. I really think that's our biggest job, is to be that facilitator between the public and the government, right? Because we're kind of in between both. You know, as much as they try to put you on this high pedestal dais, like, no, you're one of them who just so happens to be up there. And so what are you going to do for the people that you are working for? And I think being mindful that, yeah, you're employed by the city, quote unquote, but really you're for the people. They put you there. They voted for you. You don't owe anything other than the people who put you there. You know, the people are the ones who you serve. And I think that's what's kind of going awry in politics, is that, especially on a larger level, right, like lobbyists and special interests, that's where things become convoluted, which is why I like the local level, because it ain't none of that. Look, Sassoon ain't got no money. Nobody cares about us. So it's just, I'm just up here really helping people, you know, and it's great. And it doesn't have the big city politics that can really, you know, happen. And the more I see of that, the more grateful I am for my little city. Like, I'm like, thank God, man, I dodged a bullet. For real, like, I want to do this nowhere else, because it's just, it can be a lot, you know. And so really, I think just being real, being accessible, being there for people, like, honestly, and not just when it's time to politic, not just campaign season, right, but being authentically out in the streets, walking, talking, grocery shopping, I'm picking up oranges, we talking, you know. That's the kind of thing that I think is really important. And I think that that's why the local level is so special. And I think that's why it's special when you're in a small town, especially.
Nice. Thank you.
Mr. Murphy.
Yeah. Am I – actually, I just got to do a sound check. Do I sound okay?
Yeah, we can hear you better now.
Okay, wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm so glad.
We know
okay,
you're traveling. I know you're traveling. Yeah.
I am. I'm so sorry, but I was so glad to join you all this morning. You know, I love and can only piggyback off of my colleagues in saying, like, accessibility is a critical role. You know, I'm so honored and privileged to be the mayor of the city of Pinole, and to be the mayor of the vibrant city of Pinole, because I think our city, as small as it is, of 19,000, really demonstrates the power of what a small group of citizens can consistently and confidently do if they really believe in what's in front and in their backyard, right? And believe in the community that they want to set up. I think what speaks a lot, and don't tell my secret out there, y'all, but what I think speaks a lot to the success of myself as an elected, but also many electeds, is the co-governance model, right? And that's really describing and setting up as an elected system in which our institution of local government shares power with one or more entities, right, especially our community-based organizations, and the decision rights, right, in respect of matters in which our institution has that formal decision-making power. And one of the ways I think is really critical in doing this is through participatory budgeting, right, really putting the hands of the budget, you know, in technical aspects, but also in, you know, philosophical aspects, and to the hands of the residents, right? The benefit of having systems and forums and budgetary workshops and, you know, surveys and, you know, real applicable data points that set up residents and knowing what we're dealing with as electeds has propelled me forward. This is where you kind of get both, right, values of accessibility, but also authenticity and really hearing, like, here are the systems that exist that make it hard for cities like Pinole to, you know, propel into, you know, having, you know, universal basic income or, you know, making sure every single pothole in our city, right, is fixed, all roads are fixed. And I think there's so much value in co-governance right now, again, especially in smaller cities, but actually all cities. Acknowledging that, like, there are a lot of systems in place to make sure that certain communities don't get what they deserve, but also bringing in those people. You know, one of the things I say a lot in Pinole that some of my mentors taught me is that we move at the speed of alignment, right? We don't move the way the mayor wants to move or the way the council wants to move. We move at the speed of alignment. That means all quote-unquote branches of local government, the council, the city staff, and the public. And I have really brought co-governance as a value and my leadership as I see it as an opportunity, again, to expand, right, and to grow. And as we move with alignment, we also bring more people in, right? We are able to bring in other cities who are doing similar things. We're able to acknowledge that there are people who have moved into our city who may not know what Pinole has been or is visioning to become, and we have to move in alignment with them as well. You know, as much as I am proud and honored to be the mayor of Pinole, I originally come from San Francisco, California, and from a neighborhood called Baby Hunters Point. And one of the things that, from a young age, many of us as Black San Franciscans who have dealt with the experience of displacement, have dealt with the experience of over-policing, have dealt with the experience of environmental toxins right there in our backyard and in our front yard again, right, diesel power generators right there behind us as kids are playing playgrounds, right, contaminated soil, right, that corporate polluters have put into our neighborhoods and said they cleaned up and they actually did not. We know that as we have dealt with these issues in our own city, we have also moved around the Bay Area and also across California. And in that same regard, those issues that existed in those cities like San Francisco, we are able to apply our experiences, right? We're able to apply our values. And we're also able to apply our lived experience from those moments to really connect to more communities across the East Bay, right? And in many ways, like in Pinole, so many people have gone unheard, right? So many people have, you know, kind of steered away from engaging in their local government, primarily because of their, you know, really survival. They're wanting to survive and not finding an avenue to both be listened to and also spend their energy there. So I think that, like, working on co-governance for me as a model of leadership, as a model of institution, as an approach to change institutionally, has been very eye-opening. It's taught me a lot, but I also think it has engaged our residents in a way that they hadn't been engaged before, that allows them to be more active and really hold, really hold power, right? And that's what at least my approach to even being in this work, being an elected, means is it's about transforming systems of power. It's not just simply about, you know, holding a seat, holding a title, going to great events. Those are all, you know, and great assets and privileges that I get to have. But again, I think, you know, Mayor Pro Tem Washington says, like, this is hard work too. And so, you know, as pretty as the events and ceremonial moments are, right, the hard work of addressing issues on a Sunday night, on a Saturday morning, when your residents are waking up at 2 a.m. and they're thinking about, you know, how their electricity bill is going to continue to get paid, when they're thinking about the power shutoff that's happening because of a wildfire because it's too windy in the city, those are real things that happen and these real issues that local government officials we have to address. And what is really, again, such a huge opportunity for me is to be able to do that, centering the co-governance model, right, and centering people in their own, and elevating their own power to people to move forward.
And that is what we as a collective have been doing to enter transformative change. Thank you, Devin. That was a great way to wrap up that session. And I will just say really quickly, by returning, what I see from my perch over here as one of the greatest assets for all three of them is the ability to, Ms. Washington, Mayor Pro Tem Washington alluded to it, is the ability to know when to ask for assistance and to know when to ask for questions. And I will say that for all three of them, knowing all of them, is to know when to say when someone else has expertise in something, can you assist me with this? Or, you know, I know that you have expertise in this, or let's talk, or let's go to lunch, or I'd like to get more information on this. And that is a honed skill, right? And that's a skill that many seasoned politicians, people in politics, I should say, don't often utilize or don't often know, because a lot of people are afraid to say that they don't know something or that they don't know the answers. And when you're relatively new in this field, it's something that a lot of people don't do. But when you have an organizing background, as Melvin stated, it does make it easier. And one of the things that I've witnessed, and he said it, is the ability to listen is a really good skill. And for anyone who's thinking of, especially young people, if you're thinking of entering, whether as a candidate or someone helping a candidate, that ability to listen and follow through, those two skills are paramount to being in these spaces. Whether as an organizer, as a candidate for elected office, or as someone who just wants to move into these transformative spaces. We can't change systems of power unless you can do those things. Unless you can listen, unless you can have an agenda that is forward-thinking, and unless you are willing to actually take action as our guests have done today. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you so much, Mayor Pro Tem Washington. We appreciate you. Thank you so much, Mayor Devin. You know, I'm going to keep calling you that. I know you tell me not to, but I'm going to call you that anyway. Until this year is up, you're going to be mayor. And thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Willis, Melvin. I know all of them, so I'm going to tell them this. And we appreciate you guys. We appreciate the work you're doing and the example that you're setting. Civic engagement is one of those things that we ask for, but very few step up and step in to do the hard work. Anything else you want to add, Sister Martella, Brother Fleming? You've got about 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Right.
Thank you for having
us on the show.
Very encouraged.
Absolutely.
By these young elected officials.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you back again later in the year and tell us what you're doing and how we can support you. I will put all of your information on social media with a copy of this broadcast. And, we'll follow up with you in a few months later in the year and see how you're doing and what else we can do to support the work that you're doing. Thank you so much. And we will see you all next week, God willing, inshallah. Map 5. And that's a wrap.
Map 5.
Have a great week.
Have Thank a great you. Week, Have a great everyone. Week, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
All right, bye.
Blessings. Assalamu alaikum. Blessings, everyone.